new book, The Comedians, Drunks, Thieves, Scoundrels, and the History of American Comedy by Cliff Nesteroff, is an expansive and entertaining history of comedy spanning more than a century, from vaudeville through radio, television, the counterculture, the comedy club boom, to the present. Based on over 200 original interviews from major stars like Mel Brooks and Steve Martin to forgotten nobodies and extensive archival research, the book offers a comprehensive history of stand-up, a quintessential American art form. Cliff Nesteroff is a former stand-up comic turned writer. The new book is The Comedians, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure.
What led you to the subject of wanting to write such an expansive look at comedians?
Well, originally, the book that I had in mind was about comedians and the mafia. Because if you were a stand-up comedian in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, or 60s, nine times out of 10, your boss was the mob. They ran all the nightclubs in America for the most part. Most people know about the mob connection to Las Vegas. Some people talk about Frank Sinatra's connection to the mob. But maybe what people don't realize is that the reason Frank Sinatra was connected to the mob, it wasn't out of choice. It was because he was performing in these nightclubs all around America, as were stand-up comedians. After Prohibition ended in 33, the speakeasies were turned into legitimate nightclubs, and the mob, of course, controlled most of them. So I found that very interesting, the idea that your job is ridicule, and yet here, if you make fun of the wrong person, your life might be in peril. So initially, that was my entry into this sort of world, and that's what I was interviewing people about and writing about. But my publisher asked me to write a more expansive history that went back further to pre-mob-run nightclubs and post-mob era of the comedy club boom right up to today with podcasts. So that's what I've done. And all the mob stuff is in the book, but there's a lot more in there now as well.
And when it comes to a starting point for you, what was a good starting point, that pre-mob point?
Well, you know, it's interesting. My publisher asked me if I would start in the days of vaudeville, because essentially that's where the term comedian comes from, and stand-ups as we know them initially started. The people that we would still be familiar with today from vaudeville days are people like the Marx Brothers and W.C. Fields, Jack Benny, Bob Hope, Milton Berle. They all got their start in vaudeville. So that was the starting point because it was still the most accessible. It still features names that we would know today. Although I worried as I was writing this book that I wouldn't be able to make vaudeville interesting, because certainly vaudeville comedy is not going to make anybody laugh today. It's a little bit abstract. Enough time has passed that we don't really get why people were laughing at these guys in the 20s. But by using examples not of people's material and not of their acts, but of their lives, of their lifestyle, I figured out a way to make it still relatable to people today, because just as today, a working stand-up on the road has a tough slog. They have to deal with hostile audiences, weird circumstances, crooked booking practices. And by focusing on that and the lifestyle of the vaudevillian, as many were addicted to opium and morphine, drug addiction, sex and violence, by focusing on that aspect of vaudeville, I figured out a way to make it interesting for a contemporary reader today.
And of course, there was vaudeville, and there was also, when it comes to stand-up, the Catskills, the Mountains, and so many comedians that came out of the Mountains that became the popular stand-up of the day.
Yeah, of course. I mean, so many of the people that came out of that scene are the people that influenced the next generation. And that's the thing I tell people about old comedy. It's, although certain people may not be a fan of somebody like Jerry Lewis.
Was it something I said? Are you sore about something, Eddie, babe?
He's a very, very sore winner. I want to say that this is the most convincing man I ever met in my life. Ed and I have been friends for years, and I didn't particularly plan on coming here this afternoon for this thrilling show. But he talks you into things. He's that kind of a convincing man. Did you ever have friends like that convince you into doing things, you know? You want to stay home in the evening, relax, and people call you up, let's go to the movies. And as you're walking into the theater, who wanted to go to the movies? I want to stay home. Well, this is the way Ed Sullivan is. He says, come on over, and you come on. This is a That's a convincing man. 3 years ago, he talked me into buying an Edsel. Agency.
They may be surprised to learn that Jerry Lewis influenced Richard Pryor early on. And Richard Pryor is still regarded as a great genius today. So some people love Richard Pryor, they hate Jerry Lewis. But when you learn that Jerry Lewis influenced Richard Pryor, well, then suddenly there's more of a context for it all. And the same goes back even further, you know, to the days of vaudeville, how Milton Berle influenced people like Don Rickles. Don Rickles considered Milton Berle his hero. And, of course, Don Rickles influenced other people. Steve Martin will tell you that Don Rickles was an influence on him. So one person always leads to another. It's sort of a domino effect, and I underscore that in my book, and I think it's both important and interesting.
You mentioned Don Rickles, and you point out in the book that the Mafia ultimately turned Don Rickles into a star. He was managed by a small-timer, taken over by a mafioso, and they used some strong-arm methods, and they got him a lot of exposure.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, that was true of most comedians in that day. They had some connection to the mob, whether they wanted to or not. It's interesting, in Don Rickles' memoir, he doesn't get into the details of this. He tries to kind of absolve himself of involvement with the mob and kind of focuses on his friend Frank Sinatra. But the reality is that in the early days, Don Rickles was a struggling stand-up comic. He was managed by this guy named Willie Weber, who was the grandfather of Steven Weber, the actor from the sitcom Wings.
Yep.
But Willie Weber handled Don Rickles without much success for quite a long time. Booked him into a place called the Elegante in Ocean Parkway, Brooklyn. It was managed by a family called the Scandoris. They were heirs to a cardboard box manufacturing fortune, an empire. And the son, Joe Scandori, managed this place called the Elegante. And when Don Rickles came through, he fell in love with Rickles. He just thought he was the greatest thing he'd ever seen. And sick and tired of managing a nightclub, Scandori said to Rickles, you know, I'd like to manage you. I think we could really go places because I have a lot of connections. And in those days, if you told somebody you had connections, they knew what that meant. That meant mob connections. So they visited Willie Weber and said, your client, Don Rickles, we're handling him now. And Willie Weber said, no, I have a 3-year contract still with my client, Don Rickles. And they said, no, you don't. We're handling him now. And in Don Rickles' memoir, he says, Willie Weber had been good to me, but it was time to move on. No hard feelings. But if you go back to the source, when I was researching this book, I discovered court documents in which Willie Weber sued Don Rickles and Joe Scandori for breach of contract. But then the case was mysteriously dropped shortly thereafter. And sure enough, Don Rickles' career was taken over by the mob. The Vito Genovese family built a nightclub for him in Miami Beach called the Riot Room. It was connected to a motel and started getting him better and better bookings. Booked him in Los Angeles with help from the little mobster Mickey Cohen. And that's when Don Rickles' career really started to take off at the end of the 50s and the start of the 1960s. I'm sure he would have succeeded regardless because Don Rickles is a great talent, but there's no question that the Mafia really helped him get going.
It's a wonderful thrill to be here with Dean Martin on his show. Dean Martin has been a friend of many, many years. Dean, I say this from my heart, really. I've never liked you. Never. I mean, where's a man going with you?
Well, it's bad.
You point out that comedians who like to ridicule and make fun of people like Henny Youngman and Shecky Green and Joey Lewis, that they escape death in many cases for making fun of the wrong person at the wrong time.
Yeah, it was a very common story for a lot of the old-timers to have raised the ire of the mob because they were not necessarily the most humorful people, so they could not necessarily take a joke if it was directed at them. But a lot of these comedians would accidentally offend somebody who was connected to the mob. Jack Carter told me a story. He insulted a lady's hat in the audience. She was wearing this flamboyant hat that was distracting the show. But little did Jack Carter know that this woman was a mobster's mole, so that when he insulted her after the show, he got a visit from some tough guys, and a fellow connected friend had to kind of cool their jets, as it were. That was a very common plight back then. Joe E. Lewis is the best example. He was a stand-up comic in the late 20s in Chicago who defied the mob. They had booked him into a place called Green Mill. And after a couple months of playing the Green Mill, Joey Lewis accepted a gig somewhere else there in town. And his bosses said, you know, you cannot just leave and go work another room. And Joey Lewis said, well, why not? You're not the boss of me. And they said, yes, we are the boss of you. These people were connected to the Al Capone mob at the time. And to teach him a lesson, they went up to his hotel room. It was rumored to be Sam Giancana, a eventual very notable mobster, at the time just a low-level guy. They went up to his hotel room and severed his throat. They sliced it open and sliced his vocal cords. And Joey Lewis lost the ability to speak for several years. He miraculously survived. He was caught just in time by somebody who noted this pool of blood pouring down the hallway and saved him just in time. But he lost the ability to speak, had to relearn how to speak. And after several years, his throat had healed. He could speak again, and he started to do stand-up again. And because he never squealed on his detractors and because he survived, he suddenly had the respect of every mafioso in America. He became the mob's number one comedian, and they booked him as a headliner in everywhere from the Copacabana in New York to Ciro's in Los Angeles because he was considered now a survivor and a solid guy because he didn't squeal. But it became a cautionary tale for every stand-up comedian that followed Joey Lewis.
What happened with Jackie Mason? Why was he so disliked?
Jackie Mason, it was crazy. When I was researching this book, everybody who I interviewed who was a contemporary of Jackie Mason said the same thing, essentially. They would say, Jackie Mason, one of the funniest guys in the world, as a human being, I can't stand him. And I am cleaning up the language in these sentences for the broadcast. But he was much maligned, and he was just kind of a selfish performer. He would step over other people. He would use other people. He was known to be not the nicest person towards women. Was rumored to be very abusive, to the extent that in 1966 there were three separate attempts on Jackie Mason's life. A gun shot through the window of his Aladdin Hotel room in Las Vegas, lodged two bullets in the headboard above his bed. He narrowly escaped that. On a Nevada highway, somebody drove into him head-on in an attempt to kill him. And in Miami Beach, he was pulled out of a car and beaten up, all in the same year. So he was much despised, but the real true reason is hard to determine. It just seems that he rubbed everybody the wrong way. Even in the late 60s, when he had a controversy with Ed Sullivan that a lot of people know about, and he was banned from the show for a while for a gesture they considered obscene that he did on camera, columnists at the time said that very few had sympathy for Jackie Mason, despite the fact he was in the right. Just because he was a difficult fellow at times, was the way the columnist put it at the time. So just off stage, he was considered not the easiest person to work with and maybe not the nicest guy.
I found out in this business you can't please everybody. Some people like you, some don't. Do you notice that? I think in your case, most people don't.
When you were talking about Joey Lewis a moment ago, you used the term cautionary tale. You also tell in the book another cautionary tale, and that's the story of Vaughn Meader. Of course, had one of the best-selling records of all-time comedy records about President Kennedy, a satire of the president and his family. He had a red-hot career, and then it came to an abrupt halt, of course, when the president was assassinated.
Yeah, it's really a tragic thing. Vaughn Meader, like you say, he had not just the number one best-selling comedy record of all time, but up to that point, the best-selling record of all time, period. And like you say, he did a JFK impersonation. He was essentially an amateur comedian plucked from obscurity by two disc jockeys who had an idea to satirize President Kennedy on record. It became an enormous sensation. They could not print this record fast enough. All the big record stores extended their hours to accommodate the lines and the demand. At that point, you could buy the vinyl, but they could not print the cover fast enough. So you got a coupon that said you could come back in 3 weeks and pick up your cover for the album because they couldn't print them quickly enough. So he was sent on this nationwide tour. It got lukewarm reviews because he really didn't have that much experience. He played Carnegie Hall and kind of bombed, but regardless, he was still unstoppable in terms of demand. He was booked for the Grammy Awards, the Joey Bishop Show, a folk program called Hootenanny. But then, of course, the president is assassinated, and all Vaughn Meader has is the JFK impersonation. So now everybody's invoking the act of God clause. He's canceled from the Grammys. All copies of the LP are recalled in December by the record label. And Vaughn Meader is essentially washed up just as fast as he became a big star. And this kind of messed with him mentally a little bit to go from the top to suddenly persona non grata. He tried to put out other comedy records. Nobody really wanted them because it reminded them that the president had been assassinated, this great national tragedy. Von Meter was searching, wandering, trying to get something to click. Eventually went a little bit crazy, started eating out of dumpsters, started doing a lot of psychedelics, wandered the desert, became a born-again Christian, then moved back to the state of Maine, where he became a country and western barroom piano player. So, yeah, a very strange, strange and sad tale, that of Von Meter, the man who had the best-selling comedy record of all time.
As we wrap up, are we in a good place right now with comedy and comedians?
I don't think it's any better or any worse than any other time in our history. Comedy is always popular. Right now, we're going through a big boom period. Comedy is very hot. There's all kinds of articles every day about this or that comedian, true and fabricated controversies. Comedy is very popular. This boom will eventually bust, just like the 80s comedy club boom busted, but that doesn't mean it's going to go away. Comedy will always remain. It's never not popular with a contingent of people. I think comedy is alive and well and pretty healthy, yeah.
Well, the name of the book is The Comedians, Drunks, Thieves, Scoundrels, and the History of American Comedy. The book is published by Grove Atlantic. Cliff Nesteroff, I thank you very much for spending time with us this morning.
Thanks, Joe. I really appreciate it.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book is The Comedians by Cliff Nesteroff. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.